a bad time to get a message of recovery. There's no certain time of the day set that we can get a message of recovery. Any time, late time, first start in the morning. And a midnight meeting is good because that's when a lot of us, I ain't gonna say a lot of y'all, I know most of me did my dirt. So, without further ado, I'm gonna ask Justin, that's who you say, right? Justin, to introduce the speaker. All right.
Hey everybody, my name is Justin, I'm an addict.
Hey Justin!
I've had an awesome time at this convention. Yeah. And this is a good amount of people for a midnight madness, you know, speaker meeting. It's not bad for a midnight speaker meeting. And so they asked me about, 5 minutes ago to introduce you guys as midnight speaker for this convention. I traveled here from Atlanta, Georgia, and I have a group of friends that do a podcast, a recovery podcast, and we meet up once a year at different conventions, and this is the convention that we met at this year, and it's been an amazing time. I had no real intention of coming to this convention, but I have a partner who's in recovery, and that's the reason I'm here. She dragged my ass here, and I'm glad that she did. And so we came, and we've had a really good time so far. The person that you're going to hear speak tonight is my best friend. You know, so even if you hate it, you know, try to clap a little bit, maybe give a little some laughs here and there. But it's my best friend, and I met her 2 years ago. I'm divorced. She was happily divorced. I was happily divorced. And we have blended our families. Not blended our families in 30 days, right? You know, we can just meet and move in together at 60 days because we both have a little more clean time now. But over the last 2 years, we've blended our families. And she's become an amazing mother to my three children. And I thoroughly love her recovery. I love what she brings to my life. And I hope you guys get a message of hope. And with that, I give you Hannah O. from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hey guys, I'm an addict named Hannah.
Hey.
I'm a little tired, and I'm a whole lot of cranky. But we do recover, so here we are. I think it's important that you guys know where I come from. So you can understand where I am today. And so I was the third child and the only daughter to a family where my father was a ultra-conservative Southern Baptist preacher. That's how it started. And in childhood, how I was raised, my dad would tell my brothers they could one day be pastors. And then he would turn around and tell me that maybe I could be a missionary or something. And if you don't know the finer nuances of religion, it's important that you understand what that meant was that because my brothers had the luck of being born with dicks, they could be leaders. And because I had the audacity to be born with a vagina, I was less than. And that was the message I got every day, day in and day out, my entire childhood. And as I grew up, I learned that we had to be perfect on the outside. And on the inside, it was shit. So on the outside, my father was the pinnacle of perfection. He could preach in any pulpit, anywhere in the country, and people would love him. And behind closed doors, my parents would be screaming at each other day and night. It was the exact opposite behind closed doors, and we better not tell anybody. It was a secret, because we had to be perfect on the outside. And my father would preach every Sunday about being holy and a perfect person for God. And then behind closed doors, that man had a raging porn addiction. If you're asking yourself, how the hell did a five-year-old little girl know that her daddy had a porn addiction? That's because my brothers found it at a very early age. And they would watch that shit in front of me. And later, my oldest brother became my abuser. And so I grew up my whole life being abused by an older brother in a conservative Christian family where everyone thought we were perfect. And I couldn't tell anybody because then I would be in trouble. I would be the one who was in trouble. Because I was a woman. I was a girl. And therefore, I was leading them astray. And so that shit was kept secret my whole childhood. When I was 17, my other brother and I hated each other. He was 2 years older than me, was aware of the abuse, and never said shit. So, of course, we didn't like each other very much. He never stood up for me, and I tattled on him all the time. So, it's just that we just never got along. And when I was 17, my oldest brother and my abuser went missing. And we were trying to figure out what was going on. He was in Texas. We had moved to Georgia by then. Dad moved us around a lot. He always got fired from churches. God knows why. I never found out, but he did have a raging porn addiction, so one can guess. And my brother had gone missing, and I was sitting with my brother David, and we were trying to figure out what was going on. My parents weren't in the room, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and for the first time in our lives, he took me by the hand, and I said, "Are you scared?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm scared." And it was the first time we'd ever had any real vulnerability with one another. And within 2 weeks, we found out that my oldest brother had been murdered as a direct result of his addiction. Now, at 17 years old, I was still Holy Hannah. It was my nickname in high school. I was perfect in every way that I possibly could be because it was the only way I could get my parents' approval. I was a late bloomer to addiction. And so I was also voted most likely to become a nun. That shit did not work out, y'all. I also had a True Love Waits ring, which I don't know if you know what that is, but that's where you promise yourself to be a virgin until marriage. Also didn't work out, and I sold that shit for crack later on. winning. So as the murder trials were going on, because I found them pretty quick, about 6 months later, that brother that held my hand that day was diagnosed with a rare form of brain cancer. And still hadn't picked up, and my parents were shit by that point. Between the grief of my other brother and David's cancer, they just couldn't keep showing up. They were never very good at it to begin with. And so my senior year in high school, I spent a lot of nights in the hospital with my brother. And the doctors had let us know that we should prepare for the worst, that they didn't really expect him to get better. And late one night, after medication at like midnight, my brother turned over to me and he took me by the hand and said, "Hannah, are you scared?" And I said, "No, you're going to be just fine." Because that is what you say to someone who is dying. And somehow, either because of my parents' twisted faith or my inability to let go, he pulled through. And he was never the same, but he lived. And 6 months later, my dad was fired from another church, and the place where I'd found a spiritual home abandoned me. And then 6 months after that, I went to college. I was a sheltered, naive kid, and I discovered substances. Within like 2 days, I was like, you know how some people really have a really long ramp up to being an addict? Man, I was fucked from the first drink. I found a way not to feel, and I felt so much every day. I woke up every day at that point wanting to die long before I had ever used. And for a brief period of time, the drugs and alcohol is a drug, I'm tired. they kept me alive. They kept me from killing myself. And it didn't take long for it to like flip on its head and for me to be dying from the thing that was keeping me alive. I ended up in the other fellowship 6 months after I started using. I couldn't stop. I was blackout every time and started experimenting with other stuff. And I would find men on occasion, and boys would kind of stabilize me for a while until that shit got rocky, and then I'd go off the deep end again. And that would become a pattern for years, right? And I finally found a long-term boyfriend that didn't leave me, even though I cheated every time I got blackout drunk, and stuck with me and moved me from where we were out to Raleigh. And a few months after moving there, we broke up for good. And man, Raleigh was a druggie's paradise. It was up in the 95 corridor. That shit was good. And I made good money as a telemarketer because I could sell shit to a sewer. I still can. And I had this ability, right, to make enough money to feed my habits. And then I met another man, as one does. And the thing about dating and recovery is that you really should not marry men you meet at your dealer's house. And I didn't know that, so I did it. And what that man would do over the course of the next year was get me so high that I would be in overdose. And then as I was in overdose, instead of doing anything about it, he would sit and watch. And then systemically and consistently sexually assault me as I was coming out of it. And he moved us across the country to get me away from the friends and family that were trying to warn me about him. And I finally ended up in a place so dark and so deep that I called my parents from a payphone, which still existed in those days. I'm glad, because he had turned off my cell phone because it was a way he could control me. And I called my parents from a payphone, and they came and got me. Now, don't get it twisted. My parents are not good people, but they love being the heroes of everyone's story. So thank God for codependents, because they did come out and get me. And they put me in rehab, and it was the last time I saw that man. I somehow miraculously made it out. And as I was getting out of rehab, I didn't want to be the poor preacher's kid just out of rehab, because Daddy just got a new church. And my brother said I could come live with him. He was out in Philadelphia. And so I got clean on January 3rd of 2007, left rehab, and landed in Philadelphia in February. I had never lived further than Raleigh, North Carolina, and it was cold. It's cold in Philadelphia, and it's 22 degrees, and I landed, and I get off the plane, and my brother is there to pick me up at 10 o'clock at night, and he holds up his cell phone with a weather app, and it says it's 22 degrees, and he's like, I want you to know that I want you here, but if you get high in my house, I will put you on the street, and I do not give a fuck if it is 22 degrees. And he put me in the car, and I looked over at him, and I said, David, are you scared? And he said, I'm petrified. And it's how I knew that he didn't think I was dying anymore. And so the next night, I went to my first meeting out of rehab. It was a Friday night meeting. Friday night, through Principles We Unite meeting of Narcotics Anonymous in Percocet, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour north of Philly. And the women at that meeting changed my life. It's funny because I ran into like four of them at the World Convention, and they all have the same clean date. Like, I've known them since the day I walked out of rehab, you know? And I found this woman named Jill T, and Jill is still one of my dearest friends today and was my first sponsor. And she started working the steps with me immediately. Man, I got a first step, right? And I looked this woman in my life, like in her face, and said, I don't want to be powerless anymore. I have been powerless my whole damn life. And that woman was so calm and so kind, and it was the opposite of any person in my life that I've ever had. And she said, baby, you're powerless, but you're not hopeless. And so she worked a step with me in a way that allowed me to understand who I was and who I could be. I was absolutely powerless, but I was not helpless anymore. And she walked me through it step by step. And on the second step, she showed me that having a power greater than myself had shit all to do with God and everything to do with the world around me. Because I didn't want to believe in the God of my parents. That God, first of all, was a man. Fuck that shit. And two, that God, whatever I had in my head, wasn't working for me. And so I found a power greater than myself in a man named Walt. Walt was a home group member. And I was desperately trying to get laid that whole first year. And there weren't like a lot of people that were young in that area, but there were a few, and they wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. And I did not realize until much later that Walt had threatened every single man in that meeting within every inch of his life. And I want you to understand, Walt was a union man, pipe fitter, country boy from outside of the burbs of Philadelphia. And he was threatening pagans. I don't know if you know who these people are. They are not to be trifled with, and Walt didn't care. He saw a scared girl and made sure that I was safe in the meetings and the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. Walt was a power greater than myself, because Lord knows, that was not something I could do for myself at that time. And in that second step, I started trying church again. It wasn't really working for me, but Jill was calm and she was patient, and I liked following her around like a little puppy, and so I'd go on occasion. And there was one night, some woman was speaking, and she had been working out in Myanmar. I don't know if you guys know where that is, but it's like this Southeast Asian country. And I had learned in childhood that having a spiritual connection to God meant sometimes listening to a small, quiet voice. And so even though I had no idea what I believed in God, and I certainly wasn't ready to figure it out, I did believe in that voice and that inner direction. And I looked over at Jill and I whispered real quietly, "Jill, Jill, God wants me to go to Myanmar." And Jill, in her infinite wisdom, looked over at me and whispered back, "Bitch, you're crazy." And then she just got out of the way. She just let me do my thing, and I got on this like hyperfixation. I realized I couldn't get into Myanmar. It was controlled by like an entire military junta. But I could get into Thailand, which was right next door, and that seemed close enough. And the only way I could do that was by going back to school, and the only way I could use school to get there was through the Peace Corps. So I had this whole plan. I mapped it out. I found a school, and I applied, and for some ungodly reason, they let me in. And I started going to school so I could go into the Peace Corps 3 years later. And I did that all in the course of about 65 days. And she never stopped me. She never told me I was crazy again. She just showed up. And by that point, she wasn't even my sponsor anymore. Beth was my sponsor, and she, because I changed sponsors, like I changed boys like every 6 months, you know. And that was supposed to be funny. She packed all my stuff up and she moved me on campus, and she moved me on campus because I had lost my license for a full 5 years. I moved on campus, and I fully believed moving on campus that I would not get to Thailand for at least 3 years. And I had been on campus for about 15 minutes, and I met this woman. She lived in my dorm. Her name was Esther, and Esther was this beautiful, gorgeous Ghanaian woman, and I told her why I was at school and what I was going to do there, and she looked at me and she goes, "3 years! Ha! My boyfriend Anders, he is going to Thailand this summer. Would you like to go?" And so what I envisioned as this plan for my life in 3 years' time happened within 65 days. And by that summer, I did indeed have a passport, and I was going off to Thailand to be of service. And through that time I worked a third step, and I fully developed this understanding of God at that time for me and my life, and God was still not a man, and I didn't know exactly what that looks like, but I knew there was a God for me, and I was not it, and neither were you, and that was all I knew, and that was enough. And while on campus and going off to Thailand, not once but twice, I then started a fourth step and fully accepted my childhood abuse for the first time in my life. And with a sponsor and an outside help, confronted my parents and let them know what had happened to me as a child. And my father's response was absolute denial. And my mother's response was, I always thought something was going on, but I asked you once when you were 7 and you said no, so I just never brought it up again.
That part.
And that wasn't the end of my relationship with my parents, but it was the beginning of the end. And through a fifth step, I was able to finally understand who I was capable of becoming. And it was on the sixth step that I realized that who I was really good, that my defects of character were only my assets gone wild. See, I had become a rebel with no cause. My whole degree was an act of rebellion. I was getting a degree in religion just to piss my dad off. And I had an emphasis on ancient language, which means I read Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic and a wee bit of Latin. It's really rusty now. I don't count the Latin anymore. And it meant that any time my dad brought up any kind of theology, I could look him in the face and castrate him with my words. And that shit felt good. And I learned in a sixth and seventh step that I could take that defect of rebellion and hone it and whittle it down and have a purpose and a passion. And so every time there was a group on campus that was oppressed or had repression in their lives, I identified with them in a real way. And I would take up that cause because I am loud, I am mouthy, and I give no fucks. And I went so hard that I almost got kicked out of undergrad. This becomes a theme. It's not the only time I've almost been kicked out of school. I got called to the dean's office several times for my activism. And I don't care. It was the right thing to do. In an eighth step, I realized that the person I owed amends to the most was my brother. And I owed many amends, but mostly to him. And the summer I was graduating, I got to come back to Atlanta. He had moved down here again, and I made an amends to him. My parents too, but mostly to him. And had this opportunity to sit over hot McDonald's French fries, which were his favorite, and milkshakes, and talk about what it meant to really make an amends. And a month later, I flew out to Thailand again. At that point, I had gotten into grad school, actually, like this really prestigious school, and I'd gotten like a really good scholarship. And before I made the decision of whether I was going to go to grad school or back to Thailand, I called my sponsor, and at that point it was Stacy, because again, every 6 months, just like I changed my men. And I got Stacy. I called her up on the phone. And I was like, Stacy, I don't know what to do. Like, I've been offered this opportunity to go back and be of service in Thailand, or I can go to Princeton, and I think I'm going to go to Thailand. And Stacy, in her infinite wisdom, said, bitch, you're crazy. And then she got out of the way and let me do what it was I felt I should do. And so I packed my bags and I flew to Thailand. What I didn't tell anyone except for Jill T, I sold everything I had except for two like plastic bins, and I put those in Jill's attic. And the day I was putting them in her attic, I said, I'm not coming back. And she goes, baby, I know. See, at that point, Thailand had become home. It was a place I went to for my spiritual center. It was where I felt the most used to the people around me. I was good at the work. And I was learning Thai just so I could translate recovery literature. It is wild to learn an entire language just to see if you can translate it for fun. But there I was. I wasn't being paid to do it. So I flew off to Thailand with no intention of ever coming back. Now, when you're in Thailand, every 3 months you have to cross the border to get your visa renewed. And that year was the first year Myanmar was no longer in a military junta. It was the safest place to cross, actually. So I crossed into Myanmar to get my passport re-stamped after being there for 3 months. Took a shit in Myanmar, got some really cheap cigarettes in Myanmar, and then I crossed back because it's not like the safest place to be. And I was like, man, I finally made it to Myanmar. And within 24 hours of that crossing and a fulfillment of what I felt was that still, quiet voice that had called me there so many years ago, I got a phone call that my brother's cancer was back. And my mom and all of her idiocy was like, don't worry, like just stay, it's your dream, you don't need to come back. And what she didn't know is me and my brother had a pact that if he ever got sick again, I was his medical power of attorney. And so within 12 hours, I had packed my bag and was already flying back. I landed 18 hours after I got the news in Atlanta. He was 2 hours out of brain surgery, and I didn't know if he was dead or alive. And I got to the hospital, and we had a quiet moment alone. And he took my hand and said, Hannah, are you scared? No, I'm not scared. Because that's what you say when you know someone's dying. And 3 months later, on my clean date, I put that boy in the ground. And man, he had to go and die on my clean date like the asshole he was, you know? And I was stealing my thunder. At 5 years clean. Yeah. I had been back only for about 3 months, but I had already met a man, as one does, and in Northeast Georgia at that time, there wasn't a lot of women with clean time, and so in the 3 months I had been there, I already had 8 sponsees, and when my brother died, he was my reservation, and I didn't want to stay clean anymore. I did not want to stay clean anymore. My body cried out to use every day. And I stayed clean for 2 reasons. 1 was because that man would leave me if I got high. And 2 is because every one of my 8 sponsees had had a sponsor who had relapsed. And I wasn't going to be one of those bitches. And so I clinged on with a white knuckle might of someone unwilling to die. And I stayed clean. That man later gave me a child whom I love. I love that little shit so much. He's 9 now. I kept the child but got rid of the husband. Happily divorced is right. And after I got back and through that period, I finally started working a 10th step. And the realization was that I hadn't been consistent with taking a personal inventory. Because every time I looked at the relationship with my parents, I realized all I could be was compassionate with them. I could never be honest. And the thing about compassion without honesty is that it's just codependent. And every time I was honest, I could have no compassion because I would only get to the point of honesty when I was angry with them. And if you are honest without compassion, it's just cruel. And the more I worked a 10th step, the more I realized that a relationship with my parents was unhealthy. So despite the fact that they had 2 of their children in the ground, I had a moment of honesty with my mother. And in that moment of honesty, she told me that I was disgusting. And I packed my little boy in my car and I drove away, and I have not spoken to that woman since. Because I tell you what, you piss me off enough, I'm gonna set a boundary. And once I lay that boundary down, I stay. Because the only one who has ever kept me safe my whole life is me. And I haven't done it that good for that long, but I'll be damned if I let anyone hurt me clean.
Period.
It took a long time to get there. but I was the only one who's going to keep me safe. In 11th step, I finally went back to get my master's. It took a while, but I got there. And I tell you what, in an 11th step, I learned something incredible. God still was not a man. Not for me, anyway. And in grad school, I really became radicalized to this idea of abundant compassion with compassionate honesty. This ability to be compassionately direct without being cruel, to set boundaries without being an asshole, to be someone better than I had been before. Who I was awesome, but I could do more. I could be better. And so I learned how to practice this style of communication that was so far beyond what I thought possible when I first got clean, that I had the ability to stand in the gap of people that I had never met. See, I have a master's of divinity, which means I'm ordained clergy, and don't worry, I ain't gonna bring up any God's names here because this is an anonymous program. And even God's name in this program is anonymous. And I had the opportunity through that degree and that training to learn how to stand in the gap of people in a real way, which meant once again, I was in a place where I would stand up for those people that I knew had been oppressed or had a repressive lifestyle. That meant that on a consistent and daily basis, I would go out fully tattooed, still smoking cigarettes with a clergy collar and march in pride parades. That meant that when people were protesting, I was on the front lines because you know what cops less like less than protests in the streets of Atlanta? White women with clergy collars and handcuffs on the front page news. And my ability to be a full-ass Karen in the middle of downtown Atlanta meant people who were protesting had their rights and were able to be protected. And that is what I did. And that is what I do. That is who I am. My 12th step became more than just picking up the phone or going on 12-step calls. I am very public about my recovery. My work knows about my recovery. I talk about that shit on LinkedIn. I don't give. I don't care. Everyone can know that I'm an addict. And I tell people that I'm an addict. And because of that, through my time, I worked in the tech industry for a while, I worked in nonprofit for a long time, it's where I am now, that everyone knows I'm in recovery. And it doesn't go more than a couple of weeks where I don't get a text message or a phone call or a message from someone else who works in HR, because that's what I do now, that I don't get a call or a message needing help finding support for someone in their work environment or one of their friends, uncles, cousins that needs help or a recovery house for someone else. My 12th step in action is also a practice in honesty. I fully believe that if I tell the world who I am, I give the world an opportunity to love me better. And so I will tell the world that I am an addict. And by doing that, I am able to show up for my community in a way that is more than I ever thought possible. I'm tired. And I'm grumpy. And I don't really like people very much, so conventions are hard. But I'm really grateful that while I'm not necessarily good at liking people, I have been given a gift that I'm incredibly talented at loving the people around me. And that has only come because I have learned how to love myself. When I was in grad school, I had this professor tell me that he believed I was capable of moving mountains. And that's not quite true. But even if it was, my ability to move mountains wouldn't come from like an overeducated white man anyway. At 18 years clean, I found out that the man that I was married to in my addiction was now serving a life sentence. That the wife he had after me. He was under suspicion of murdering, and that I had only escaped because he just wasn't that good at it then. And I went up to my sponsor again every 6 months, right? I keep them longer these days, just like I do my men. I found all this out, and I decided to step forward as one of his victims, public. And I was having a hard time being interviewed. This is really the first time I've ever spoken about it in a meeting or otherwise. And the article was going to come out as me stepping forward, and I went to the safety of my sponsor, and I flew up to Philly, and I stayed with my sponsor, and I was having a panic attack about it one night, and she like scooped me up and held me, and she's like, "You can stop this at any time. You don't have to do it if you don't want to." And I said, "I have to. These women have to know they're not alone." And she like kissed me on the top of my head and pulled up my face, and in all of her infinite wisdom, she said, "Bitch, you're crazy." And then she got out of the way. She's like, "Okay, let's get you ready." And we worked a step that night, and she took me on hours of shopping and took me to Christmas parties and met with other sponsee sisters and put me back together again and sent me home. Yeah, I'm not capable necessarily of moving mountains because some overeducated white man told me, but I am capable of moving mountains because I have seen these women who are mountains of recovery move out of the way for me. If you're new tonight and you don't have a sponsor, you should get one. If you don't know how to get one, it goes a little bit like this. Yo, Tori, will you be my sponsor?
Yes.
There we go. That's how you do it. If you don't have a home group, you should get one. And it's a reminder to me that recovery did not promise me that I would have this life I have today. And it is amazing, and it is full, and I've done incredible shit clean. But this program did not promise me that. All this program promised me was freedom from active addiction. And every day for the last 18 years, 1 month, and 3 days, it has given me just that. If you don't know if you can stay clean, just keep coming back. I'm an addict named Hannah. Thanks for letting me share.